This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The soap opera at City Hall, starring Mayor John Cranley and City Manager Harry Black, just keeps pumping out plot twists. This week began with charges of bribery and suggestions that we need a mayoral recall option. Yesterday, council voted to hold the mayor to the terms of the manager's original contract, 8 months' pay, about $174,000 if he resigned or got fired. No extra money like the $423,000 the mayor and the manager agreed to 2 weeks ago and council refused to ratify. The manager promptly declined the council's offer. At the same time, the manager has let council know it better spend some quality time figuring out how to close the projected budget deficit. And tomorrow is the deadline announced by FC Cincinnati to make its final site selection for a new stadium. Will it be Oakley, the West End, or Newport? Or is this not even a real deadline? To make sense of all of this, I am joined by our weekly news review guest, by WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter Chris Wetterich, and WCPO.com politics and government reporter Amanda Seitz. Welcome, everybody. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So, Jay, let's just start with the obvious question, since this is a very fluid situation over at City Hall.
Can I start, though, with the soap opera? It's funny that you mentioned that, because yesterday we were thinking about the Dallas theme with shots of the city and, you know, all the different characters for the opening sequence.
I think our skyline looks better than Dallas's. So
well, but see, it would fit right in. But instead of Dallas coming in at you, it would see City Hall.
Well, okay. I'm glad I made you happy. So any news today?
So far, all quiet today. And one, I never assume anything. Normally, things are happening between 4 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
But I would assume since Good Friday and Reds opening day that perhaps all this would wait. And if there's going to be anything happen, it would wait until next week.
I'm not sure there'll be any reporters to cover it. I plan to be drinking at Great American Ballpark at 4 o'clock today. So,
Amanda, the mayor is... couple of weeks ago, promised to hold public hearings in which city employees would be invited to testify about the abuses meted out by the manager. I mean, it was pretty clear who he was going to line up. Is that moving forward at all, do you think, or is that just a threat out there?
John Cranley said that they're gonna roll these employees out in some form over the next couple weeks, probably mid-April. We'll see if he can do it, especially after Councilman Chris Seelbach kind of said, hey, if you bring out these employees in press conferences, I don't know how much stock we're going to put in what they're saying because it's kind of politicizing the situation.
So you think it's now, if it happens at all, it's going to be in press conference rather than in front of council?
I think Chris actually tried to press the mayor a little bit on that, and he suggested maybe a committee. Obviously, there's some members of council who might be more favorable in holding a committee where they have these employees come in and testify against the city manager than others. So that's a possibility, or it could be the press conferences.
You know, the Democratic majority doesn't agree with this committee idea. They still want to hire a special counsel to, in the words of Councilman Sittenfeld, aggregate the complaints, not only against the city manager, but against really anybody else in city's leadership, including council members and the mayor. So there's not even agreement on that. And, you know, I think
he refers to that as fact finding.
Right. You know, I think Amanda made a good point there about, you know, the credibility of employees who stand up with the mayor and have a press conference and lay this out. I just don't think that the five Democratic members who are kind of controlling this thing at this point are going to find that to be persuasive, you know. And we asked – it's interesting because we asked the lawyer for Code, which is a union representing city employees, what else out there is there? You know, you guys have, you know, there's a strip club thing that Harry evidently took a trip to Denver. You know, that was supposed to be the smoking gun. Kind of wasn't. And so what else you got? And because we've seen the allegations of abuse and retaliatory conduct in the lawsuits, there's a lot of documentation of this at this point, and it really hasn't moved the needle. And the answer was kind of like, well, we can't tell you until we really get organized and, you know, get our ducks in a row and tell you. So I'm kind of at a loss as to what else there is.
I think what the mayor is hoping to achieve here, though, if he does go forward with the press conferences, is to appeal more to the public, right? I mean, putting the pressure directly on council that way. So we'll see.
Well, I haven't sensed any, like, public outrage about mm-hmm. this. I just don't see it.
In fact, if anything, I feel there's outrage against the mayor.
Right. Well, and I think Councilmember Sittenfeld said it best yesterday. Most of the public is thinking, what the heck's going on down at City Hall? But basic city services, as he referenced, you know, potholes are being filled. Police are still answering radio runs. Fire department's still responding to medical runs. So the business of the city is still getting done. And most people are left to think, you know, what the heck's happened at 801 Plum Street?
And if they dig any deeper, they're like, wait a minute. If I quit my job, I'd get nothing. And they want to, and the mayor and some of these folks have signed off on 18 months. I mean, that to the average taxpayer, they're kind of like, that's outrageous.
Well, and I don't know how deep even the average taxpayer is digging on this,
not
right?
Much,
they
yeah.
just probably think that the whole thing at City Hall is dysfunctional.
Well, it seems that some members, at least, of what you call the Democratic majority or the Progressive Five or whatever we want to call them.
Right. David Mann's pretty progressive the last time I checked. And, so
and he's also a Democrat.
And he's mm-hmm. not in the five. And, so
that's I always right. say so, the majority. On right.
Okay, the majority. They part of that is Greg Landsman. And Landsman right. posted yesterday on Facebook a very long statement in which he said that if you move forward and force the manager out, that all we do is aggravate the racial and class divisions in this city, basically indicating that if anybody's paying attention to this, it might be the African-American community and seeing how a white mayor is treating a African-American city manager. So maybe that question of who's paying attention, it may be focused. Jay, any thoughts on that?
I think that's true. And I know there have been, and I can't name the groups that have come out, but you had the Black Agenda, the NAACP, the Sentinel Police Association, a mm-hmm. couple others.
Those are the three big ones. Yeah.
Those, you know, they have been very active. And actually, I've been surprised Joe Mallory with the NAACP, mm-hmm. I think, has been at all three of the council meetings since this issue came up. Testifying in support of keeping the city manager.
I'll be interested to see, too. I know the mayor on Wednesday, and it wasn't a very he didn't explain it very well, but he kind of tried to dismiss the people who were coming to council as part of the Black Agenda, Dwight Tillery's kind of coalition that he's gotten together to fight, like, the West End Stadium, for example, for FC Cincinnati. I'll be interested to see if he continues that. I don't think he did a really great job explaining to the public what he was trying to get at with that. But
well, one of the things that intrigued me was Wendell Young's charge that John Cranley called him up, basically said, if I understand it correctly, first off, I'm assuming the call took place. Secondly, his explanation is that the mayor said, what can I do? What do you need in order to shift your vote? And Wendell Young's reporting of this is he slammed the phone down and he called this bribery. First off, what's your reaction to that? And
to me, that's politics 101.
That was my reaction.
That happens all the time. It's probably happened since the beginning of democracy. I think for it to be bribery, to me, it would have been to offer him something personally to support an agreement. Like, you know, I'll give you $10,000.
It would have to be something of value.
Yes.
Or I'll give you a car or something. But saying, you know, what would you trade support for? If I supported this, would you support me? That's for lack of horse trading in politics. And it happens all the time.
Well, it is telling that it's 1 o'clock on a Friday, and we haven't gotten an update on the charges that were supposed to be pressed from this.
One of the things that did intrigue me about this, though, was, again, assuming the call was actually made, that the mayor thought that Councilman Young still might switch his vote. I don't perceive him as one of the people who might switch.
You know, first of all, it's a silly charge, but I do think the mayor has tried to extract himself from this by, you know, basically asking council members, you know, what can we do to make this better, but also get Harry out the door. And, you know, I think that they're not inclined to let Harry go for any amount of money, you know, that's beyond the 8 months that they approved the other day. So, and I think the reason that he probably called Young was because, you know, these guys in the majority, I think that they're going to stick together thick and thin through this. So, you know, he may have to start with the person who is maybe the most extreme in his dislike for the mayor, you know,
in order to swing it.
Right. Do the hardest thing first. That's I guess, speculation on my part, really. But, you know, really kind of a silly charge by Councilmember Young. But at the same time, I think that he views that as fighting fire with fire, right? The mayor has leveled all kinds of charges against all kinds of people over the years. So turnabout is fair play in his mind.
Well, let me ask just one question before we have to take a break. What's the exit strategy here?
What's the end game?
How do we get out of this?
The thing that I find interesting, and Dan, you've been around Cincinnati covering politics longer than I have, but normally when a city manager goes, they go. Mm-hmm. There's no drag out. When their time's done, they're gone. And I'm not sure that anyone really knows what the exit strategy is, right? Somebody will have to blink.
That's it, yeah.
The mayor will have to blink. The manager will have to blink. One of the five that's in the majority. And right now, everybody has pretty well dug in, and I'm not sure. I mean, I have some ideas. I don't know if I publicly want to state them, but there's going to have to be something to change one of those folks who are dug in. And so far, in 3 weeks, that hasn't happened.
Talking about what's happening at City Hall is where we've been focused. I've got one more question on that, or actually two more questions, and then I want to move on to some other things. There's been a lot of sort of theories or, you know, should the charter be changed in certain ways that have come out of this situation? So, for example, should we go to an executive mayor, not just a directly elected mayor? But this week, somebody floated the idea of a provision to recall the mayor. Now,
Wendell Young, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was it Wendell? Okay.
Yeah.
So no matter what, onto the ballot, I'm sure it would not affect this mayor. So it doesn't affect this situation. But again, is there any support there?
That always comes back to how do you get the. It's almost like the people being dug in on their positions. Everybody has something that they want to be a part of this overall plan. But then when you put it all together, well, the charter committee may not support that. The Republicans may not support this. The Democrats may not support this. And basically, I think that's sort of how we ended up with the system that we have now. This is what they could get on the ballot.
This is the compromise.
And this is what would pass.
Yeah, I think that any charter amendments, and it's not only the recall of the mayor, we've also heard we're going to go back to 2-year council terms. We're going to, you know, we're going to have an executive mayor. Those are Councilman Smitherman's ideas. I just think anything that comes out of this in terms of amendments to the charter is going to be viewed by the voters as tainted. The last time we changed the charter successfully to go to the stronger mayor, there was consensus.
I insist
on
direct elected, not stronger.
Stronger.
I just don't buy that.
Yeah.
We did, as we're talking, we got a rather lengthy emailed statement from the mayor's office. I was hoping I could read all of it, but it's too long. But there is one section that is sort of news. I'll just read it directly. Next week, I will propose legislation to obtain an independent third-party special counsel, as my colleague suggested 2 weeks ago, that will conduct interviews and prepare a report for council and the public. I have and will continue to have ongoing conversations with council members about this legislation, and will continue to work with them to create a final ordinance that meets their request, is fair, and complies with the city charter.
So there you go.
There's some movement.
Yeah.
He's called their bluff, or he's capitulated to them, depending on what you want to, how you want to look at it,
right? Or how it rolls out.
Right.
I mean, to our point earlier, there's really no other way to get someone on board with the mayor unless he agrees to that.
Right. To the process. Right.
Right. Let me just broaden this out slightly. One is we do know now that the council has a significant budget challenge. Mm-hmm. So has there been any focus on something substantive like that this week? And again, I refer to Greg Landsman. He's now talking about a children's and family city budget. I didn't know that. I don't know what that is.
I was just going to say, I thought David Mann kind of described the situation well a couple weeks ago at council. And I think there's obviously people are still doing their work at City Hall, right? Like the staffers are still doing their budgets, working on this stuff. But I thought his description of how the energy at City Hall has been absorbed by this was also kind of fairly accurate, that it's a huge distraction, right? You know, so yes, I think people are moving forward on this and discussing the budget, but I also think there's this huge elephant in the room at all times.
In other words, the energy isn't there.
I mean, keep in mind the city council doesn't really discuss the budget until the manager and the mayor put the budget mm-hmm. out. The process usually is the manager introduces his budget, the mayor makes some changes, usually pretty minor, and then it goes to council. So that'll heat up in May.
And I know there was a lot of reporting. I was off last Friday, but I read the memo about the each department is asked to provide, with the exception of police and fire, they were asked this year to, if we had to cut 12% from your department, what would it look like?
Right.
And some of those things look pretty bad. Now, that doesn't mean that that's going to happen. That's just proposal, because I think they asked, I think
that was
shortfall,
last year.
Yeah, the shortfall, I think, is $27 million, and I want to say that the cuts totaled, maybe it was close to 40 million. So not all of those are going to happen, but those will be out there to say, okay, in a worst case, here's what could happen.
I just do want to go back to Chris's point, though, that the manager issues the first draft mm-hmm. of the budget.
Right.
And then the mayor and the manager work together in order to get there. Okay. We'll just keep moving
leave
on.
That one there, right?
Wouldn't you like to be a fly on the wall for that meeting?
Jay, my understanding is that there may be some movement on the park board and the status of the endowments that the park board controls.
We got an email, I guess it was around 11:30 this morning, that the park board is going to have a special meeting on Monday morning at 9 a.m. And the only thing on the agenda, it said Memorandum of Understanding Action Item. So I immediately emailed replied to the park board director, and it does indeed involve a memorandum of understanding between the city and the park board over the spending of those endowment funds and how it would be accounted for within the city budget. And that's been discussed 2 years.
That's a long time, Jay, long time. They've talked about it.
And it was also the kind of the crux of the dispute at the end of last year, beginning of this year, about former park commissioner Diane Rosenberg's term on the park board and Jim Getz replacing her.
The last person that the mayor tried to oust from a job, right?
Right.
Well, I want to remind everybody that endowments, you don't just spend the endowments. You spend the earnings off
correct,
the endowments.
Right. You're not supposed to spend the principal.
That's right. How do you manage the endowment?
Correct. And the concern was that these were not going through city accounting practices, and there was also some concern about whether it was being the city's bidding procedures for minority business inclusion and whatnot were being followed in that process.
Sure. Okay, so budgets in general, park board specifics. Let's move on to FC Cincinnati. And Amanda, tomorrow, Saturday, March the 31st, we've been told is the deadline. Are we going to hear something? Have you heard anything out of FC about a press conference announcing the site?
No. I mean, and this is not the first time, right, that FC Cincinnati has set a deadline and it's come and gone without any new really information.
They have one more day.
One more day, yeah. Maybe they bought up all the properties in the West End today. No, I anticipate that whatever we hear tomorrow, if we hear anything, it's going to be a lot of the same old stuff that we've already heard. I mean, you know, I could be wrong, but I don't think they're going to come out tomorrow and say it's Newport or it's the West End or I could be wrong, but I think after we've seen this drawn out so long, I don't think they have enough really in place to make a decision at this point.
At what
There's
point,
still
though,
so many balls in the
at
air.
At what point does the league, Major League Soccer, well, when do they say, we need to know what you've got, guys?
Well, they have this situation all over the country. Yeah. Sacramento's down. They're missing a billionaire. The David,
missing a billionaire.
Yeah. The David Beckham team in Miami, they have to start over with their site search. Major League Soccer, you know, people aren't folding for them like they did the NFL and Major League Baseball when they decided that all these cities needed to go build new taxpayer-funded sports palaces. So Major League Soccer seems to be in a little bit of a pickle to me.
The other thing is that the MLS has also said basically that whoever they pick next can start in 2019. Well, that's led a lot of people to believe that the MLS, if they do select Cincinnati, which I believe they will if they can get it together, can play at Nippert for a year. So I think that's part of why there's not this huge rush, right, to make sure that they have the stadium locked down, because if they do give them the bid at the end of the day, they can just let them play at Nippert for a year or two while they construct the stadium.
And there's one other one I forgot. Nashville's city council people, they want to move their stadium site from the Tennessee Fairgrounds to somewhere else in the city. That doesn't look like it's getting much traction, but even in a place that already has their bid, they're still kind of dickering over where the stadium is going to go.
Well, and they just lost their mayor, who was a huge supporter of that. So
right.
So which was an embarrassment, the way that she left.
The tweet of the week on this, though, goes to Jason Williams when he said that the site should be West Oakport.
Yeah.
One thing that we should mention about FC Cincinnati is that the mayor had said amidst all the chaos the other day on Wednesday was that he would be unveiling a package of legislation on the West End site that he supports. We haven't seen any of that, and it's unclear what it would be. I mean, I think there's a lot of potential legislation they would have to pass, including vacating part of Central Avenue near Stargell Stadium, doing some kind of, you know, additional
figuring
financial
out the missing $7.5 million that will no longer be there because the Oakley TIF money is not eligible.
Well, yeah. Do they need that? Is the infrastructure quote unquote cheaper there? I mean, there's a lot of questions about that. And there's no way, obviously, that is going to happen before March 31st.
So on my way out of City Hall, too, on what was it, Thursday, David Mann also said that he believes something is coming on FC Cincinnati after I asked if there was going to be any other news for us to cover outside the city manager. And I said, surely it's not going to be FC Cincinnati, right, David? And he said, I think it is. So we continue this.
what was David trying to indicate? That something was coming soon?
Yes, at City Hall, yes.
And the interesting thing,
we continue our grind of covering either the city manager or FC Cincinnati news.
And if that's the case, it was what the joint school board meeting with one council committee and the school board, we will not be rushed. Mm-hmm. But
end of the day, if FC Cincinnati comes back and says, sure, we'll pay your $2 million in taxes every year or whatever it's going to end up being, I think that's an easy decision for a lot of people. I think even council might be persuaded by that. I mean, obviously, there's major hurdles to overcome with the community being on board in the West End. But if Carl Lindner decides that he's ready to write those checks, I think that makes this a whole lot easier for everybody involved.
But I haven't seen any indication that that's about to happen. Have you?
I have not, but
anybody have any indication that the school Board of Education, passed a resolution saying that they were still open and here's what they were willing to do. Have you seen any indication that FC and the school board have reengaged?
No, I've asked the school district specifically about that every day except for today. Sorry. But
they're sending their letter at 4:10 today.
right. Exactly. So no, the answer is no on that one.
Well, they could be individually engaging school board members. I don't have any information that they are, but I'm just throwing that out there as well.
And one piece of news I saw before I came in, there was an email that the governor signed the state's capital budget, which includes $4 million for an FC Cincinnati stadium.
No, wait a minute. The governor of Ohio?
Yeah. The capital budget.
Because that was in the state budget.
It was in the state budget. So that has been signed. So that's long
now. That strengthens either of the Cincinnati sites.
One would assume.
Sort of, except the FC Cincinnati ownership has always argued that they never got the complete requests that they asked for infrastructure in the first place. So
At Oakley.
Yeah, at Oakley, that they needed really that $4 million to even make this happen is kind of what their argument had been.
But now that they've got it, if the governor is signed.
But they're still short.
Because that's the final step, right?
But they're still short.
Yeah.
Because I think originally for Oakley, it was like in the $70 million range, and the city and the county together was 37.5, 40.
It was 52 million.
$52 million.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have a caller. We have Jim on the line and who has a question. And Jim, what would you like to ask? Well, you're laughing too. So there's a lot of laughing today.
You know, I happened to be on the committee when the charter change was issued, and what's interesting is that the leadership that kind of goofed that up is the same leadership that's leading FC Cincinnati right now, but that's a whole other day. But during that discussion in 1998, I think it was, you know, that the reason we arrived at that is because Lucan and Chavez both thought they would get mayor if whoever got the most votes for council got mayor. And long story short, that's how that change took place. Well, it didn't work, obviously. And then going in another direction is what came up. And the, you know, charter committee didn't want, and others with similar inclinations didn't want city manager to change. Other folks thought that strong mayor, directly elected strong mayor, CEO mayor, is where we ought to go. And we ended up with that hybrid that we have now, which was a disaster. And I could just shoot myself for being anywhere close to being part of it. It seemed like we had to vote on that hybrid or we weren't going to go anywhere. And so we did. Well, the results are obvious. You can't go forward. You can't go back with this situation. And if you've got somebody in the mayor's office that accedes to the purpose of the charter, which is that city manager still is CEO, then you'd be okay. If you've got somebody who wants to exploit it because they've got they've got the sway over the mayor because they can recommend hiring or firing, that doesn't mean you run the show. It doesn't mean you hire and fire administrators, and that doesn't mean you do administrative work. But it's so confusing.
I'm wondering if – I think Chris thinks that he might have an angle on your point.
Well, I mean, this is Jim Tarbell, right?
This is Jim from over the Rhine, we're almost sure. Formerly was city council. Is that right, Jim?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, do you think that that it should be that we should go to an executive mayor? Do you think we should go back to the old council manager system where the mayor was not elevated in the charter?
I really think it's time for a commission, and we ever do on having an independent voice come into this. You know, I'm on the charter board. The history of the charter is pretty well known. Would I be open to an executive mayor or CEO? I absolutely would. It depends on who it is. In the case of Indianapolis, in the case of Louisville, you had a civic leader of some repute, very, very well respected, led the charge. That's the reason why it worked there. And I think without that, without having a commission that brings forward a leadership around one or the other, executive mayor, CEO, or city manager, without that kind of independent study and recommendations, I think we're stuck. And then we go quickly to the same thing with FC Cincinnati. That's time, you know, when you get something that's that major, I think you have to have a similar kind of commission. It could be the same commission.
Well,
and then third and lastly is that the city is broke right now, and they are not talking about that. David Mann's point is absolutely the right one.
Okay,
I'm
going to jump in here because we're almost out of time for this segment. I do want to say that 3 weeks ago, when Kevin Flynn was one of our guests just as this whole crisis at City Hall was starting. I thought he had a really interesting point. I basically asked the question, should we go back to what we had, or should we do we have to go forward to an executive mayor? Kevin's response was, I think the genie's out of the bottle. I don't think we're going backwards. The question may be, if we have to go forward, what's the right way to do it? And this was, I hear Jim saying, we need a commission to put all of that together.
Well, the city recently had a commission, correct, on the charter review?
That was an internal.
2014?
It was an internal.
It was internal, but I mean, they were outside.
Yeah, there were outside.
There were hearings and public.
Yeah, they did quite a bit of work.
Nothing happened, so.
Well, I mean,
the problem always comes back to with any of these, everybody wants the buck to stop with someone.
Mm-hmm.
And the trick is getting to a system where that stops with someone that everyone can agree on.
I just want to remind everybody on that, though. One, this manager was put forward by this mayor, mm-hmm. and this mayor was just reelected.
Yeah.
So, you know, the holding people responsible, we just reelected this mayor. So anyway, I want to thank all three of my guests, Chris Wettery, Amanda Seitz, and Jay Hanselman, and hope that the next time they come back, they've got some definitive answers to all of these
things. Stadium site in Oakley.
The presence of the Ku Klux Klan, white supremacists, and neo-Nazis in our region is not new. But their boldness and openness about efforts to shape the social and political environment is startling. A front-page investigative report in last Sunday's Cincinnati Enquirer caught many people by surprise. I'm joined now by Cincinnati Enquirer education reporter and the author of this article, Hannah Starling, and the author and her photographer, Liz DeFore, who together worked on this project. Welcome. To Cincinnati Edition. Hannah, how long – I mean, there's some indications in the article that references back to December and whatever. How long was it that you worked on this?
Well, we had it for a very long time. I think we first started back in August after Charlottesville. Mm. And then just kind of off and on, we would chip away at it, chip away at it. The thing that we ran into was we kept finding one more thing we needed to look into. So that's kind of why it took so long.
How did you – how were you able to find people to talk to?
That was not the most difficult part.
And the second part of that is, what was their willingness to talk?
Most people were pretty open. We talked to Matthew first, Matthew Heimbach. He's the founder of the group.
And want to give the name of the group, Traditionalist Workers Party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I just called him and said, hey, can I talk to you? And he said, sure, no problem. And then he gave me the name of his main contact point in Ohio, and it just kind of went from there.
Okay. And you were able to find him by just going to the web, right?
Yeah, he was pretty open and easy to find.
Liz, what was your role in all of this and what were you trying to accomplish?
Well, we wanted to have their voices, but we also wanted to have a balance. So it was important. So the first time when we first started, we interviewed, I think, three of them from different – we kept on going to public libraries to do the interviews. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't want us to come to their homes. But after we had that and
– because you think they feared being revealed as to where they actually lived?
Yeah. Tony Hovater had been in the New York Times, and after that he had gotten a lot of backlash from that article. So he definitely didn't want us to come to his house. But he was happy to talk to us, have us use his face, his name, but he just didn't want us to come to his home.
But then you also have photographs in the article that show people standing up against the Traditionalist Workers Party,
right,
and these sorts of groups. So is that what you're talking about with the balance?
Right. We thought it was important that we heard from people like Sarah Weiss, who is with the Holocaust
and Humanities Center.
Right. And Carl Westmoreland from the Freedom Center. So we wanted to have those, and then Christopher Phillips, who is a UC professor. So we gave that kind of the context, and I thought that helped give a balance of, okay, here's what they're saying, and here's why this is happening here. And that's what I was trying to accomplish with the video.
Hannah, who is this group or these types of groups? And by the way, this is a group that you focused on in this part of the country,
mm-hmm.
but you cite that there's
almost 1,000 mm-hmm. of these kinds of groups that the Southern Poverty Law Center has identified mm-hmm. across the country. So who is it that these groups think their audience is, that they actually have chances of making inroads mm-hmm. with?
And that was in particular one of the scariest things to me and one of the reasons why we really wanted to do this piece. They're targeting white people, for one, young people, I'd say under 30, but early 20s, more likely, and then men in particular. So it's men and women, but most of the people we talked with were men, and a lot of the women we saw were there but didn't want to speak with us.
So that's their target, young, white.
Mm-hmm.
Poor in many cases.
Poor,
sure, yeah.
Especially men.
What especially men for leadership roles, I would say. They want women there too, but as a less vocal presence.
But what's their goal here?
Their goal, their end game is to have a white homeland, so a whites-only state. They say it would be in what they call the former United States, and somewhere in the Midwest is their aim. So really they just want to segregate and to make their own nation.
So do they want to withdraw or do they want to drive out?
Drive out, I would say.
Yeah. I think that, yeah, I mean, they're saying, like what Tony was saying is that we're not, if you don't want it to join us, you don't have to, but we want it this way, so why can't we have it this way?
And I think their point with this region is that it's heavily white already anyway. Definitely not 100% white, so there would have to be some driving out to set it up here, but that's why, one of the reasons why they're focusing here.
Do they imagine that they would still be part of the United States?
No.
So this would be a nation state. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So often people confuse nation states and country as if they're the mm-hmm. same thing. But if you think about Yugoslavia and the way that Yugoslavia fell apart and every ethnic group seeking its own nation state to express its identity, I think that's what they're sort of going after here. It's the mm-hmm. real problem of the nation state. So do they think that they're making progress? I mean, this is a pretty extreme idea.
Yeah, I would say so.
They talked about the number of their members, although we could never, even when we went down to Knoxville for the Women's March, mm-hmm. there was only 20 of them there. So, and they talk about thousands. Mm-hmm. We never saw that. The other thing that they talk a lot, but one of the things that we were going to go do was they do these marches where they practice marching, and that never came to fruition. So a lot of things that they talk about never happened.
Well, part of their strategy is that they want to do charitable work, as they say, or at mm-hmm. least as you report that mm-hmm. that they say. They want to do charitable work as a way of, one, serving the needs of the people they think they're trying to attract, but then, you know, using that. What did you find out about that? How – because that may be
right.
– I thought that might be where you were going with the – describing the problem of finding
right.
lots of people mm-hmm. marching. What happened with that?
What we found is that it really, at least from what we could see, isn't true. So it seemed to be just a whole lot of talk about all these things that they planned to do for white people to help them with school supplies and food drives and coat drives. And we saw kind of some hints of it, but it was mostly just a lot of talk about it and no action. So that's one of the main things that tells me, and I think tells some of the researchers I talked with, that they're not gaining as much traction as they claim to be gaining. But having said that, I don't think that means they're gaining no traction. I think there are people attracted to this, and the researchers I talked with agree that they are growing.
And what researchers could you turn to in this situation?
Anti-Defamation League was really great. A couple of professors at UC were really fantastic. Southern Poverty Law Center helped as well.
Yeah, Southern Poverty Law Center.
Well, one of the women that we talked to, Catherine, she's 18, and she heard Matthew Heimbach talk, and she said, I agree. I want to help. She really wanted to do charity work. They were supposed to have a coat drive before Christmas. It kind of rolled over into January. It never happened. And then ultimately, she has now left the party because she said the charity work that, which was why she joined, never happened.
So, in effect, she's disillusioned. She thought promises mm-hmm. were yeah. made that they just couldn't fulfill.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
she told me she thought she could be effective on her own, more effective on her own than as a part of their group.
Okay. One of the questions here, I mean, the New York Times, and you mentioned this, did an article on Tony Hovatar. Major article, lots of coverage, lots of room in the Times. And I think
it was a Sunday.
And I think
piece,
it was a Sunday piece,
right.
So it got a lot of attention. You've done this, and I suspect probably other newspapers and other outlets, television stations, are doing similar things. Are we normalizing these people who are extreme nationalists? I mean, are we saying that, okay, this is just one more normal sort of thing and let's get used to it type of thing?
I think we talked a lot about that, first of all, before we published. And I think even before I talked with Tony Hovatar before the Times piece even ran, so I was definitely following that.
You were already in touch with him before?
I'd already interviewed him a couple times before that piece ran. So it was something we thought about a lot. Ultimately, we decided that we just had to do it because part of their idea and their plan is to make what they're about look like something else. And so if we don't talk about it and if we don't identify it, I think it makes it easier for people to fall for that.
Yeah, that was one of the reasons, you know, the piece ended up coming out a little bit later than we had planned because we had so much discussion. I mean, I know Hannah's story was read and reread. My video was looked at a million times. And, you know, we kept on going back at it and back at it and back and back at it. But ultimately, Burl Love, the editor of The Enquirer, felt it was really important that we can't bury our heads in the sand, that these people are out there and it's really important for us to tell the story.
One thing that sort of the shorthand that sometimes gets used for this is that they are hate groups. You, I thought, did an interesting job with allowing them to respond to that sort of label, which they reject. So what's their view when they get called a hate group?
Well, the way they frame it is that they don't hate minorities. It's just that they love white people. And so that's kind of the argument. It's there's nothing wrong with loving our own families and our own people. I think a lot of people would say there's no distinction there. By the fact that you're excluding minorities from your love, that's hating.
But except for they really are not fans of Jewish people.
I was just going to say,
yeah. That's the
who's
one.
Who's excluded here? Now, in your article, you made that very clear.
Mm-hmm. And they're very clear about that as well and sort of unabashed about it. They just openly hate Jewish people.
Even more than, say, let me put other groups, African-Americans, mm-hmm. immigrants. I mean—
Definitely. It's a different type of hatred. It comes out in a different way, I would say.
Yeah, as far as like, because they said, you know, we don't hate, you know, African-Americans. We just don't want to live by them. They can go live over here. We're fine. But I think Jewish is totally different. That's a totally different.
They seem to blame the Jewish community for a lot of what they see as wrong. They have a lot of theories about the Jewish community controlling a lot of the institutions in America, just a lot of kind of just off things.
How do they see themselves, this contemporary group, related to older groups that have been around for a long time? Ku Klux Klan, those of us who have been around long enough can remember in the 1980s a Klan group coming and putting a cross on Fountain Square at Christmas, just driving people crazy. And that was a group rooted in southern Indiana. How do they see themselves related to these other groups that have been out there for a long time?
I think for them it might be more a question of when versus what. So I think they would maybe see a lot of similarities with a group like the Klan, but their idea now is that they think they're going to gain better traction and that they have a more willing and receptive audience, particularly here.
Particularly here. Mm-hmm. What makes us, again, I mean, you mentioned the demographic character, that this is more heavily white than some places.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the only reason that they think this could be fertile ground?
No, there's quite a few, actually. I think one of the main ones, and a couple of the history professors we talked with brought this up as well, is that this area was kind of in the middle ground with the Civil War in regards to race. And so it wasn't It wasn't a slave state here, but it wasn't hyper abolitionist like some of the more northern places. So in a sense, there's this idea that we sort of skipped race relations and kind of confronting that. And so now it's all bubbling to the surface later since we didn't deal with it then. We're going to deal with it now.
Well, I, as a historian myself, there's a famous sort of tradition of north of slavery. People think there's a simplicity of there's the Ohio River and there's slavery to the south and there was freedom on the north. But in fact, when Ohio became a state in 1803, among the first laws that were passed and then eventually get added onto were referred to as the Black Laws. And for all practical purposes, it's segregation, which the South then embraced after the Civil War when they no longer had slavery to define social and economic status. And so segregation is and separation was rooted in the North very, very deeply from very early on.
And you can see that. I'm an education reporter most of the time. And so there's the North is more segregated with schools than the South. So it's like it pops up in other areas as well.
What when you finished all of this, it's now been published, what's been the response?
We've actually had surprisingly a pretty positive response. I mean, obviously there's been some people who, you know, there's been a few, you know, emails that, you know, especially Burl has gotten that have been negative. But for the most part, people have said thanks. You know, this needs to be said. This needs to be out there. People need to be aware of it.
It's been much tamer than I thought as well. We were kind of prepared for a big blowback, but it really didn't come. Yeah. There have been some negative things, but some positive things as well.
So is that because you think that people have seen bits and pieces of this already? In a sense, you kept having to go back and rework your piece. As a reporter, I know what that feels like. And it's like, oh, I might have missed the opening that would have really made a big splash.
It could be. And I hope it's also a little bit because we were so careful and so intentional about rounding the piece out.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both my guests here this afternoon, Hannah Starling and Liz DeFore of the Cincinnati Enquirer, for their great work on this front page story last Sunday, if you missed it. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer, Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website WVXU.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned now for 91.7 for Science Friday, coming up next.